Hello and welcome to Insight is Capital. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. In this episode, we're diving into one of the most transformative shifts in investing today, private markets. For decades, access to private equity, private credit, infrastructure, and real assets was largely reserved for institutions and the ultra wealthy. That's changing. Advisors and individual investors are increasingly being offered ways into this once exclusive world. But what does that democratization really mean in practice? What role should private markets play in a modern portfolio? And how are new fund structures evolving to make these strategies more accessible? To help us explore these questions, I'm joined by Raphaël Gauthier-Grenier, Senior Director of Investment Solutions, Private Investments at National Bank Investments, and Ross Nielsen, Principal at Apollo Global Management. Raphaël leads the development of private and alternative investment products, bringing deep expertise in structuring solutions that bridge institutional strategies and individual investors. She holds CFA, MBA, and FP designations and has been driving innovation at National Bank Investments since 2019. As principal at Apollo Global Management, Ross leads the firm's growth strategy within Canada's wealth, intermediary, and high net worth channels. He brings more than 25 years of experience in financial services, spanning both asset management and corporate banking.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Raphaël, Ross, welcome. It is terrific to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Pierre. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Before we kick things off, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your careers, how you got into the private market space in the first place, and what you're working on these days.
Of course. So I began my career in ranches, working directly with clients as an advisor. Early on, I really discovered a strong interest for investments. And I decided to take on various roles in the mutual fund distribution. And then I dedicated the second half of my career to investment product structuring, first on the public mutual fund side, but now since a few years in charge of the private investment strategy at National Bank Investment, with a clear focus on developing this offering and making NBI a leader in that space.
I started in the industry back in the sort of mid to late 90s and was lucky enough to kind of find myself a job at the entry level at a mutual fund company and work my way up through sales and a variety of sales roles. About halfway through my career, I made a switch over to corporate banking, working for a couple of large US institutions that had corporate banking operations here in Canada. And I returned to the asset management business back in 2013, got really more focused on alternative investing, and had an opportunity to move over to Neuberger Berman, which was predominantly to bring private markets funds into Canada. I was approached by Apollo about a year ago and was given the opportunity to come over here and build out their Canadian business, really focused 100% now on alternatives.
Let's start wide angle. Private markets have been gaining so much momentum globally and here in Canada. From where you sit, what's behind this surge in attention? Why are advisors and investors suddenly leaning in more than they did even a few years back?
Yeah, there are lots of reasons for that. The first one is really the democratization of private markets. And what that means is that a lot of new products are available to retail investors. These are open-ended product or evergreen, as you said earlier. So it really shifts from traditional investments who were made designed only for institutions and very ultra-wealthy families. These were products with very long long time horizon. So they had to be held for 10, 15 years with no liquidity or very little liquidity. But now the products that are in the market today and what you design at National Bank Investments are products that are open-ended, that you can get liquidity very more frequently, that are tradable on platforms that are really wide recognized and widely used by advisors. So it's very what created that interest from advisors across Canada to really get access to private market. There are other trends. The second one probably is that now active marketing is really made regarding private investments, which was really not the case a few years ago. And there's active wholesaling in the market. So now advisors are, those strategies are pitched directly to advisors, which is what not really the case a few years ago. And also we see banks making partnerships as us or even others, where this sends a clear signal in the market in Canada, because distribution in Canada is really, is a lot driven by also banks and their distribution channels. So when they start incorporating these products for retail investors, it creates something big. And now everybody looks at that and really tries to understand a little bit what happened now. And maybe, and then maybe Ross, I'll get your perspective on that. But there's also kind of a saturation in the institutional market players, where private equity firms and private credit firms are looking for new sources of funding and new capital bases. So now they go directly to retail, something they didn't do before because they had enough to just do their businesses. But now retail are becoming a very good opportunity for growing their business. And this is why they really want to reach out to those. And maybe, Ross, I'm pretty sure you can add a little more on that. And also what happens after the great financial crisis and the shift they saw from a little bit more public to private.
Absolutely. I think one of the key things as well is that the demand works both ways. I think there are more and more companies that are accessing private markets as opposed to public markets to raise capital. And obviously, institutions have a limit in the amount that they can invest in those areas. So it's really important to find other sources of capital for these companies. As Raphael mentioned, after the great financial crisis, a lot of the banks in the United States moved away from their traditional private lending for a variety of reasons, both structurally and also due to regulation. And firms like Apollo and our competitors were able to step in and kind of fill that void. For many, many years, as Raphael mentioned, it was really the space of the large institutions and large wealthy families that began to access that. And then over the last couple of years, it's been both inbound demand from retail investors and high net worth investors that are maybe below that single family office size that have interest in the space. And also innovation structurally that have allowed us to create products that actually fit more readily into advisor portfolios that have sort of kind of hit the perfect timing in the last couple of years to open this part of the market up to more retail investors.
At the entrepreneur level, which is, you know, the business owner who also, you know, likely happens to be the high net worth or you know, well-heeled investor looking to invest. If anyone understands that space very well, it's that entrepreneur, right? They've gone through their trials of raising capital, going to traditional banking and finding that difficult, and then seeking out other sources of capital like private markets in order to help capitalize their businesses. And so for an advisor coming to the table with that client, which is a lot of their clients, and beginning that conversation, it should be fairly natural to have that conversation, because suddenly it's an eye opener. It's you know, you mean I can actually invest in these areas of the market where, you know, it was impossible before?
You're completely
right.
Yeah, completely, exactly. And then when you do that, it's a natural fit, as you said, with entrepreneurs. But before that, if you were to go to a private equity deal, you had to come in with 20, 25 million.
Plus exactly.
One deal. Like no diversification, no any strategy, only one manager. And that was a very big blocker for many clients that were wealthy, but we're not all for wealthy. So now the conversation can be around that and how the businesses are structured and how they can invest in those. Because like private markets are not that different to like companies and what public market do. It's just another way of doing it. It's financing or investing in equities, but it's the same kind of investment than the rest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a big education for advisors as well. But once they get their clients comfortable, often, especially those entrepreneurs, will understand exactly what's going on. It just takes a little bit of education because they've historically been investing in public equities and ETFs and more traditional mutual funds. So to wrap their head around, you know, the different structures of liquidity, et cetera, it takes a little bit of time. But once they view it as something very similar to their own business, they become much more comfortable with it.
It might be as simple as just pulling back the curtain.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And showing that, you know, that end investor, that client, how it all works. We keep hearing, we keep using the word, the phrase democratization of private markets, and it can sound like a buzzword at times. What does it actually look like on the ground? How is access changing for Canadian investors who aren't institutions or ultra wealthy families?
Well, I would say it's not a buzzword because really what's happening, like this is the best way I think to put it. And it's really giving access to a majority of investors or many investors right now. And of course, for private investments, they have to be accredited investor. It's technical, it's a regulation. But to put it simple, it's like wealthy families. So if you have $200,000 of income per year or $1 million investable assets, or, and this is very important, if you have a discretionary advisor. And discretionary advisors are a lot of the clients in Canada. So all these clients have access, even if they don't need like their wealthy minimums. So BIVs get also a broad range of clients having access to those products now. So this is what represents democratization a lot. And you combine that with the new products that we have, while we can have like low minimums. So now you can range between like 5,000 to 25,000 to get into the product and not 20 to 25 million. So that is very, very huge. And this is why the access is now getting more simple. You also have like products that are tradable on Quantser. Quantser is the trading platform that connects all systems that advisors are trading on. So this also is a very big shift. Well, there are, of course, liquidity, and we're going to talk maybe a little bit later about liquidity. But of course, those minimums are so low, and you can have so many different ways to get liquidity now that this is what opens up these products for clients. And also by that, it allows to go into model portfolios. A lot of advisors are trading the model, and now you can incorporate some of those products into their models, making it more friendly to trade and explain to their client and create in bulk trade for everybody. And we were like, we included our National Bank investment. We included private assets since 2018 in our model portfolios. So we were early in that space. And today we sit at around 15% for some of our model portfolios in private assets. So this is really evolving. And this is what I mean by democratization.
Yeah, I think I would add to it from an asset manager standpoint as well. A big part of it is technology. So it used to be that, you know, we would have firms that would come into our closed-end funds, and it was relatively easy to do fund accounting because you would have 15 or 20 or 30 large investors who didn't need to know exactly what the value of their investment was every month or every single day. It's much more challenging when you are looking at retail investors because you could have hundreds, if not thousands, of investors. So when things changed structurally and they started being able to list funds, put funds onto FundServe, it took the burden of knowing every single end investor off of the backs of the managers like Apollo and others. So working with firms like National Bank, it makes our life much easier because we view them as one client. So it's very easy for us to structurally understand that. And it also helps that the calculation of the net asset value, technology there is also expanded dramatically. So we have third-party valuation agents that have built out the technology to help us say, this is exactly what the portfolio is worth every single day or every single month or every single quarter. So that's helped a lot.
That leads us to the mechanics of how this access, I know we've touched on it already a little bit, but that leads us to the mechanics of how this access is actually being delivered. I want to talk about sort of the evolution of fund structures. Traditionally, private markets came with long lockups, steep minimums, and almost no liquidity. Those were significant barriers that kept most investors out. But now we're seeing innovations like evergreen and open-ended structures. Can you talk about how, or break down how some of these newer structures or formats work and why they matter for advisors and their clients? I think Raphael, you might have touched on it as well in terms of you know, how they fit into model portfolios and discretionary accounts with discretionary advisors. But can you maybe elaborate on evergreen and open-ended structures?
Yeah, there's much more to say to it about that. So maybe like the first thing is that these evergreen structures are really the key to unlocking access to private markets. But before I dive into those structures, I'll just do a little bit of step back to look at traditional private equity funds, let's say, just so we can compare both and make sure we understand. So let's say you take a private equity closed-end fund like Russ just mentioned earlier. So what happens is you have a private equity firm wanting to get assets to raise a fund and to invest in some assets. So what they do is they start their raising capital. So they go to investors, okay, they commit an amount. So let's say I commit to you $50 million. But as of the moment of the commitment, no money is given to the private equity firm. So the money gets in like in the advisor's portfolio or the investor and nothing happens. So then the private equity firm continues on that period. And once they close that period, they will say, okay, now we're today 2025, the fund starts. So it's going to be closed then. So nobody can get in. And then you have a number and a vintage we call. So let's say it would be 2025, a bit like wine. And then you would get that exposure and then it's locked for 10 to 15 years. And then you would start getting distribution. But as of the close update, there's no investment made. So client is still into the investment account. And then as the private equity firm would find opportunities and companies to invest in, they would start calling capital. So we call that capital calls. And then when they do that, they will send like 7 to 15 days to the investors a notice, and then they would have to wire the money to the private equity firm. So you can imagine that this structure is very complex for advisors and retail clients to have all this to fill and to have managing like liquidity, mismatch, no access after for 10, 15 years. And then to exit those funds. Of course, when you get underlying investments, what you have to do is either you improve the company's revenue, so you get some streams of revenues, you can get distributions, or you exit. You sell to a third party, you do an IPO or whatever, you can do a few mechanisms, but it takes time to get onto that and sell the businesses. So this is why it's very complex, and this is what was available before. Now, evergreen structure, what they do is they bundle those strategies together. So everything, like the manager is managing all that burden, paperwork, fiscal optimization, everything, and they wrap it in one product called the Evergreen product. But you still have the liquidity issue, right? Because you want to give liquidity to your investors, but you have a liquid asset. So you have a mismatch. What do you do? So what we normally do is we have a liquidity sleeve. Everybody gets it differently, but we had a certain amount of liquid assets on top of that, that some make it more cash, some replicate more like indexes of the strategy we're trying to develop, because in private markets, you have a lot of strategies. And then you say to investors, I'm going to give you some liquidity, let's say quarterly. You have some terms, but now you don't have anything else to worry about. You just invest. We do everything for you, diversification, manager selection, capital calls, because capital calls are still happening within the structure. And then it's kind of peace of mind. So that's, if you can explain it, it's really what our evergreen funds are. You want to add, Russ, on that?
Yeah, and I also think one of the benefits of the evergreen pool is that you have so many different transactions that are going in to these pools now that actually there's a constant flow and an ability to put money to work much more quickly within these pools. It tends to lend itself to certain aspects of the private markets better than others. Like there are some areas where it's very episodic, and so those can be more of a challenge to get money put to work. But in areas like private credit, there are just so many ongoing deals. We have constant deal flow. And also the thing is they actually pay out interest. So there's constant money flowing back into the fund that allows to facilitate liquidity and other things. So not every private deal fits perfectly into an evergreen structure. And I think that's something important for people to keep in mind. But with the advancement of technology, I think more and more we're seeing a lot of opportunities to put different asset classes into those structures.
Yeah. I mean, it's not hard to see how it has become very investor friendly. I mean, to be able to put together these complex structures into a wrapper and make it available to investors in a way that works for them and matches up with their expectations and their, you know, their sort of wish list of how they'd like to see it work. It's definitely a lot friendlier.
And maybe if I can add on that, I think some are better than others at structuring those products. But like what advisors really need to focus on is also like how liquidity is managed, because you have some liquidity mechanism at the fund level. So let's say lines of credits, what the liquid split is made of, things like that. But also, as Ross said, at the underlying investment level, like what are the liquidity profiles of the assets you buy? So let's say, to make it visual, like an infrastructure fund is harder to make in an evergreen format than, let's say, a private credit or even like real estate credit or real estate types of funds. So this is also something really to look at. And then the dispersion of return and fund profile between managers is very large. It's wider than in the public market. So to choose the best managers and making sure you select like strong players in that field is very important also for advisors.
Yeah, one other thing I did want to mention as well is there's been an interesting shift even in the institutional world where they're more and more looking for evergreen product. Maybe getting into the weeds a bit, but typically when they're going into a closed-end product, it has to tie in with their investment time horizon. So it has to be like, we're looking to add to private credit, who's in the market right now? And they have to underwrite these new transactions. Even if they've already worked with the firms, it's like underwriting an entirely new deal. So more and more institutions are coming and saying, we prefer evergreen. We just want to know, you know, we like Apollo or we like Blackstone or whoever it is. We just want to keep giving you money when we have the opportunity to invest. And so that's also helped us build out better structures, because when we have large institutional clients that we've already worked with really closely who want evergreen structures, I think that actually benefits the retail client as well, because we're going to build it the same way.
And they know exactly what they're getting right away.
Exactly.
And also explained a little bit like the growth of the secondary market. Because secondary market is like where you exchange private equity, because there's no active market. That's the point. It's private. But you also have a place where you can exchange some of those deals. So private, like secondaries, is getting a lot higher. And while you have some good opportunities in secondary, but you have also to be careful, because you don't want to buy, because what happens is you buy asset at a discount, and then you can keep those assets, increase the NAV of their value, and then you keep going. But you have to be careful that the firms you're investing in or partnering with don't do that in a way that there's no upside afterwards. So they buy at a discount, big discounts, but then the value of those assets doesn't have any future upside. So this is what really advisor and even us, when we look at deals, it's really something we look at and make sure that secondaries is made right. There are lots of opportunities. But in retail products, of course, sometimes there are some deals that should not necessarily be there. So that's why it's really important to look at that.
So there's a lot of fundamental analysis, like bottom-up analysis,
yeah,
in the secondary market. Just like with stock picking, you want to determine the correct valuation and the right discount for that valuation when you get into a secondary.
Exactly. So you need a team like advisors. They have a lot of knowledge. They know how to serve your clients. They are very good. It's just that this is a very specific set of skills. So investment due diligence is very important. So let's say for us, we work with our pension fund team, which have a track record of 20 more years doing that for our pension fund. So they work with us to select those best and recommend investment in that case. So it takes a really good team to really go and make sure you get the right deals.
I think not unlike traditional mutual funds, there are great managers, average managers, and below average managers. So it's not all private equity and private credit funds are the same.
Yeah, you can see where there is also, I mean, there's a great opportunity to unlock value, right? I mean, every manager has their secret sauce, and you know, they may turn around, look at a deal, either, you know, discover that a deal is overpriced based on its discounted cash flow model and valuations, or they might see a deal and, you know, see a tremendous margin of safety in that investment and see where, you know, maybe we could unlock this much more value in this opportunity as well. So it provides an opportunity set that you can't really get in public markets, because so much information is already discounted into the price of public markets. But in private markets, you can see there's a lot more inefficiency potentially to unlock value and opportunity just by recognizing that things are a certain way. If we zoom out to portfolio construction, where do you see private markets belonging in portfolio construction? Is it mainly about higher returns, low correlation, like, you know, as a diversifier, or perhaps even inflation protection these days?
I think that this is an evolving topic. If you listen to our CEO, Mark Rowan, speak about it, he's got a lot of great insights. I think what we've typically seen historically in portfolios is it was the old 60-40, which was public equities and public fixed income. Where we are now is, I think, 60-40 plus alternatives. So now it's kind of public markets with everything bucketed into the same bucket. It doesn't matter if it's venture capital or really high quality private credit. Everything is loaded into that alternatives bucket. And people are viewing it as a way to diversify and a way to get a little bit more yield. I think longer term, and what our long-term view of the market is that we think at some point in time, people have their public bonds and their private bonds, or public fixed income, private fixed income, public equities, private equities, and then other alternatives like infrastructure and venture and other things. I don't think we're there yet, but it's evolving in that direction. 90% of companies are private. We've seen the number of publicly listed companies in the U.S. drop from 8,000 to 4,000 over the last 10 or 15 years, which also means that there is less opportunity to diversify in those public markets. So I think as people begin to learn this, and you know, another example is that private credit has grown to $2 trillion market since 2008. I think people realize that if you truly want to diversify, you have to have access to those parts of the market. But we're still in, I think, I always say we're in the first inning, especially here in Canada. In the US, I think it's 2 out of 5 advisors are using private markets in their portfolios. It's less up here. And I think it makes up less than 2% of client portfolios. So I still think it is very much at the beginning of what people are going to do over the long term. But long term, I do think it's a necessary diversifier to have access to broader parts of the market.
Thanks, Ross. I just wanted to touch on the point that you made earlier, Rafael, about the minimums that are established on, you know, with these new evergreen structures. You know, when you can get in for $5,000 or $25,000 minimums, that really allows for the investor or advisor who wants to take a more gradual approach to this to wade in at a level that is comfortable for themselves and for their business and for their client, right? Overall, but then to your point, Ross, you know, you mentioned, for example, private credit as a $2 trillion market cap. When you compare that to the 110 trillion or so that represents public markets market capitalization, that's roughly 2%, right? So. You know, if you're a believer in systematic or passive investing, you know, taking a passive allocation across all markets, then that should at least represent 2% of your portfolio. Private credit should at least represent 2% of your portfolio. Private equity should represent a proportionate exposure to your overall portfolio. And likewise, all the other, you know, alternative market caps, if you want to, as a starting point. Not necessarily as an aspirational level, but as a starting point for portfolio construction, it should weigh in at least at those levels.
And maybe I can also comment on their role in the portfolio and like advise, like private investment can fit so many roles and goals for clients, because that's a private credit. You can make it fix into fixed income, more like allocation. If you work with very large cap private credit funds, like the one we just launched, but and then private equity is really more like diversification of opportunities, higher expected return. This is why they necessarily use it to give some torque to the portfolio. But even within private equity, you have subsets. So you have buyout, growth strategies, or if you really want something to do a home run, you have venture capital, but you have also higher risk. So it's really not everything is really not equal in that space. And then when you want to go into more like real assets, so infrastructure, real estate, and even agriculture and timberland, this is normally for higher yield, inflation protection. So it really depends on what you want to add in your portfolio. If you really, like these days, we hear a lot of advisors wanting things to uncorrelate with public equities. So like our real asset is very like popular in that sense for now. Many clients have a lot of real estate exposure already because they have homes, they have rental properties. So sometimes they want to have something else. So then private credit could be interesting. So it really depends on the client's need and how it fits into their whole financial planning at the end of the day.
Very much agree. I think, as I mentioned earlier, not all private assets are created the same. And I think over time, they like right now they sit kind of in the same bucket. I speak to advisors all the time and they say, well, I've got my private exposure and typically it's one fund. And I think over time they will start to diversify and realize that there are opportunities, you know, across the spectrum. And again, as Rafael mentioned, it's everything from really, really high quality private credit that, you know, I often will fit very simply in a fixed income bucket all the way to the most risky, you know, secondaries or venture cap buckets as well. So I think over time, we're going to see that diversification come. It starts, I think, with the structural changes that allow people to access it. And over time, it will be high quality companies launching great products and advisors getting comfortable with the structure and then beginning that diversification process.
Exactly. Let's talk for a moment about the opportunity set of private markets. One, and to your earlier point, Ross, one remarkable revelation that still gets me about private markets is that in the US today, for example, it's an eye-opening fact that over 90% of companies with revenues exceeding $100 million per year are private. And proportionally, that's true in Canada as well. What do you think that means for investors? I think when people find this out, this revelation alone is enough to spark a huge amount of curiosity. You know, we're not talking about, you know, thousands of small, you know, mom and pop businesses that are looking for private money. We're talking about companies that have revenues in excess of $100 million, you know, being that proportion of all companies in the space.
Yeah, I think it is shocking to a lot of people when they hear that. And I think it's also growing. As I mentioned earlier, the number of listed companies has shrunk dramatically, not just in the US and Canada, but in Europe as well. So I think that when clients begin to learn that, when advisors are speaking to their clients and telling them that, I think that will also open the door and make them realize that they're missing out on a lot of opportunities. And I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. I think companies realize that there's a huge amount of regulatory and reporting commitments that they have to make if they're going to list publicly. And so often we're seeing companies that would have listed and gone public staying private a lot longer. I think ultimately the same goal is to exit through the public markets, but more and more firms are saying, hey, we're able to operate, we're able to raise capital, and they can think a little bit longer term. They don't have to worry about every quarterly analyst call. And they can actually say, hey, we're looking to build something out for 5 or 10 years. And when they're working with firms like ours on the private equity side, we often understand that a little bit better and we have more patience. That does tie itself to the fact that most investors in that space historically have been institutions. And again, they're also comfortable with that long-term time horizon. So that's going to be an education process with clients saying that when you're going into private equity or even private debt, you know, you need to hold these things through a business cycle. And it's not something that, you know, you're going to buy today and sell to go buy a cottage in 3 months. It's, you know, hopefully the clients have that understanding that they need to get in these things for the long term.
But that's
regardless of liquidity.
That could be also good for clients because sometimes it protects against themselves. They don't get emotional and they can sell at any time. I think those private assets can keep a kind of bucket of kind of safety against themselves for a long term. And also, let's say you take an objective that is very long term, like retirement and retirement account or things like that. It can be also very suited for that, as anyways, you're not going to withdraw from those investments.
Yeah, it definitely promotes the behavioral advantage of patient capital, right? And that's a very big part of, you know, the value of advice too. you know, you don't get to see the daily gyrations of the stock prices of the companies that you own in the private space, but that's a good thing. You're actually providing access to the illiquidity premium without the illiquidity.
No, you're right. I mean, the illiquidity premium is something we often discuss internally. And sometimes we say, is there really an illiquidity premium in everywhere? I'm not saying it's there every time. Like manager selection is very important. And there's also a lot of alpha generation. So it's when you analyze it, it depends on where you look at. Illiquidity is present, so advisor needs to be aware of that. Even if we build structure with that are evergreen, there could be moments where liquidity is more, is less than what they would anticipate or anything like that. But I think it's really structurally made so that there is access to liquidity, and then you get the full benefits of private assets, whether it's illiquidity premium or alpha or just investing in those companies and getting the returns they're supposed to be.
Yeah. And I think, with private credit, especially, you look at, historically tight yields right now in publicly listed fixed income across high yield and investment grade. There are often times where firms like ours are able to structure deals at significant premiums to what you would do in the public markets. And companies are willing to pay that excess spread for a variety of reasons. And it isn't because they are riskier firms. It's simply they want guaranteed outcomes. They want to be able to work with firms that can come in, with two or three parties that are lending as opposed to, a huge consortium of lenders. So there's a lot of reasons why we're able to generate excess returns. Again, the managers matter, but I think that illiquidity premium, especially in markets like right now, we have, ultra hot equity markets that are very concentrated and again, really tight spreads and fixed income. I think private equities and private credit are offering a lot of advantages in this space. And I also joke about liquidity. I sort of have a tongue-in-cheek joke where I say, if the S&P only valued once a month and you can only get 5% out a quarter, people might actually do a lot better. Because again, it protects them from themselves a little bit. So I think that's important too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that reminds me of the ongoing, Dalbar studies. Right, where the investments perform better than the investors.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the possible nuances in the Canadian marketplace. What do you see looking at the Canadian landscape specifically? Are there any trends that stand out to you?
Sure. I mean, I think historically Canadians have always been really big investors into real estate. So I think that was an area that kind of took off faster than others. As Raphael mentioned, I think everybody's long real estate through their own homes, et cetera. But I think people were comfortable with it in the same way that you kind of mentioned that, small business owners and business owners might be more comfortable with private equity and private credit because they understand it in their day-to-day lives. I think most Canadians understand real estate. I think what we're seeing now is there's been a prevalence of private credit coming to the Canadian market. I think it is a great first step for people to get comfortable with it. I think it makes a lot of sense, again, in the credit environment that we're in right now, that people are looking for that excess yield. But in spite of, in my industry, I hear about it all the time and advisors are often saying, oh, well, there's already a lot of private credit out there. But again, it makes up less than 2% of advisor portfolios. So I think that's where we're seeing a lot of the growth and a lot of the momentum. I think private equity is going to be the next wave, but structurally it's more challenging. So I think people have to build it out properly. They have to invest into the right kind of deals and work with the right managers. I don't think it should just be, hey, there's an untapped opportunity to raise capital. I think it has to be raised properly.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Ross. And I think the see momentum in all asset classes from our advisors. Probably like private equity is often what they want to talk about when we meet advisors, but they end up buying real assets or private credit because then the conversation shift. I think private credit had bad press in Canada for a few reasons. Some small players or wrongly, I would say structured product had liquidity issues and it's created a bit of noise for advisors. I think when you go in, you really have to take that into consideration and really explain why the products that are launched are more, I would say, solid or higher quality deals that you're bringing to the table. So I think that's very also important. I think the entrance of really banks into that, as I said earlier, is a big trend, and that's going to also influence a lot the market and what kind of strategy are presented to advisors. And then I would say that there's more scrutiny at the gatekeepers level for every dealer, like what kind of products they accept. They will want to have like higher quality products, in-house product. And the reason why is because when it's a product that is manufactured or where the partnership is made in-house, they have more control, or not control, but I would say more transparency on the holding and more comfort on the strategy. So this is why it's very important to get on those platforms, really explain the value of the proposition and the way it's structured from the investment strategy side, but also from the product design side.
You mentioned that, you know, the conversation often starts around private equity. I can see why. I mean, if we're dealing with advisors, equity is always sort of the subject of at the forefront, because that's where growth is coming from in portfolios historically. But you said something interesting, which is that you know, it shifts then to real assets and you know, private credit. Because now, is that where you see the most momentum?
Yes. And there's two reasons. As Ross also said, like private equity, when you get into like your real liquidity and how it works, and the correlation might be a little bit higher to public equities in some cases, also how the products are structured now, because you have like liquidity in there. So it's really, so they start to really realize that. And sometimes then they say, okay, I want something more lower volatility, maybe uncorrelated a little bit more. Okay, and now I can get yields. I thought like private credit was only super risky assets with leverage strategies and things like that. And then you realize, oh no, okay, there's private credit that really looks like investment grade in a way. So then they say, okay, I can put that into that portfolio for those clients. And then the conversations right. gets a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, as a substitute to today's rate environment, volatile bond market, higher for longer, and really, you know, a lot of uncertainty in traditional bond markets, when you can get into private credit deals where there's floating rate structures, for example, you're getting that uncorrelated exposure to fixed income. And I can see, like, you know, in a word, it's ballast, right? It's the ballast that they're looking for against the equity risk that they want to keep on taking.
Exactly. And inflation protection also these days is very on top of mind. Like everybody wants to
absolutely
protect it against yeah. that. And a lot of assets can really do that job in a portfolio, especially when you talk about, you can have like agriculture, you can have real estate, some types of real estate, infrastructure, things like that that generate a constant return over time. That can also really help reinforce portfolios.
I think another thing that's maybe a Canadian nuance, and working for a large US firm, but being Canadian, I certainly noticed this. Canadians like income. They like dividend paying stocks. They like real estate for that reason. And I think that's another reason why the conversation will often make its way back to private credit, because Canadians like to see yield. They like to see money flowing into their accounts.
Okay, great point. What do you see as being particularly or especially attractive right now in the private space?
I would say right now, again, private credit is pretty much the fastest growing part of the market, even in the US. I mean, we're definitely seeing it on the retail space, and we're seeing it a lot in the institutional space as well. That's where they still have a lot of appetite. And I was going to say, whereas in private equity, obviously it's sexier or whatever, and people really like it. But I think that a lot of firms are starting to find, and this is another interesting thing on the institutional level, I think a lot of institutions have built out their own private equity teams, and they're doing deals more directly, where they don't do that as much in private credit. They tend to invest more through fund managers. So I think that's a bit of a nuance as well. But I think it's the logical first step for retail clients to get involved in. There are more products out there in the space, so it also gives them more selection, the ability to pick which managers they want to work with. I think over time, we'll start seeing private equity structures evolve and become more popular.
I agree with you, Ross. And I think also private credit is easier to start with, as there's more cash flows. It behaves a little bit more like fixed income, something they know. They will start returns coming in. Liquidity is a little bit higher from the design and from the underlying structure. So I think that's a really good way in for advisors. And then they will add more sleeves to their portfolios because they have to get comfortable. They will start with something. They will feel it, experiences. Like for a lot of advisors, it's the first time they have products with monthly NAVs, like monthly valuation, or even some products for quarterly. So they have to get their head around that. And if they want to redeem for clients that say it can take 3 to 4 months to get the cash back, and it's not something they're used to. So I think to start with 1, 2, 3 products, it will get comfortable and then it will add a lot more.
Yeah. One quick thing to add as well is it will also have to rely on some changes internally with compliance. Because right now, everything is bucketed into the alternative bucket. As I mentioned, right. It doesn't matter if it's venture capital or if it's really conservative private credit. So advisors are limited in the amounts that they can put in. So if they have a couple of hedge funds that they're using, they have to find that space, even if it's for a private credit vehicle. So I think that that will evolve over time as well. I mean, compliance is certainly looking at it right now, but I think it will take time for them to get comfortable with saying that, okay, this can actually fit into a fixed income bucket, or this can fit into a traditional equity bucket. That's going to take some time for people to get comfortable with.
And also on how like they will test that asset allocation. So let's say they limit to a certain amount of the portfolio, but the markets are evolving and they can't get out any day. So they have to find ways to follow compliance, but also in a way that it's most suitable for those investments.
To bring it back home, what is National Bank Investments doing in this space? How are you helping advisors and investors tap into private markets? And what strategies or partnerships are you most excited about right now?
Well, there's a lot to talk about. Very excited. Yeah. It's very exciting. So first, just to put a bit in context, so National Bank Investment is like the leading open architecture platform in Canada. So what it means is that we do partner with the best managers in public and private markets. So it's in our DNA to find the best managers, and we are really geared towards that. So it's really the same approach for private investments, and we have two types of products. So the first one are pooled funds with multi-managers, diversified exposures. So I would mean like it's very turnkey solution, very high quality and institutional style. So it's really the same approach that we had with our pension fund for years that we are bringing for our advisors. It's into a lot of our models. So very large base of investor, very diversified and very peace of mind. And we have that special thing on those pools that are daily valuation. So you can get in and out. So it makes them very model friendly. But they are actually very concentrated and private. It's just by design, by the pool and how we made them that we can get to that result. So these are very interesting. We have one in private equity and one in real assets, fully diversified. And then we have our new business that we're really working hard on it. And we just partnered with Apollo on a fund. So it's a new lineup of evergreen structure with only one manager. So strategies that we are very like convinced on, and we can bring one single manager in an evergreen format to our clients. And we just launched the NBI Apollo private credit farm. So it's their flagship strategies in the US, a very large cap quality focus, kind of similar to investment grade, even if it's not investment grade per se, but really same approach, institutional quality, and very like, I would say even conservative approach, because we don't want to put our clients in very high risk structures. We want to have like a good experience and that those assets really fit in their portfolio and that clients can get to their goals. So that's really our mindset. And our role is really to become a leader in that space. And this is really what we're working on.
We're really excited to be entering the Canadian market. We're doing it through partnerships like our partnership with National Bank. Again, our view is we're not going to come and launch a mutual fund company in Canada. We want to work with firms like National Bank that have great distribution, great structuring capabilities, and we focus on our asset management. I always like to tell people that, you know, Apollo differentiates itself by the fact that most of the transactions that we have in our funds, we own on our own balance sheet. So we always hope that people understand that and that we're fully aligned with our investors. I think that's a big thing that we bring to the table. But we're really excited about the Canadian market. We think that the Canadian market is a very developed market. They're more conservative, which really suits us really well. And we think that there's a huge growth opportunity up here.
Yeah, and it's like it's something to invest there. Like, you need to be careful about liquidity structure, leverage, but also like the size of the manager, the track record, the history of the firms, and the due diligence, like the level of investment due diligence that is made on those deals. I think that's really something they have to look for when they sell like private equity products. And I think we're really delivering that with our solutions right now.
Rafael, Ross, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. This has been an incredible discussion, really in-depth and granular about private markets.
No, thank you very much, Pierre. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.